Good day, and welcome to the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn this conference over to Director Phil Keith. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chantel, and good afternoon, and thank everyone for joining us today. I call the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice to order, and on behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank you for joining us today for this important commission teleconference meeting. This week's hearings will focus on criminal justice issues in rural and tribal communities. And today we'll hear about a variety of challenges that occur in rural America and Indian country. For more than a year, I've been conducting listening sessions throughout our great country for Attorney General Barr. And working with our U.S. attorneys, these series of rural listening sessions have invited me firsthand the challenges faced in these communities. And these challenges are far different than anything most of us experience on a day-to-day basis, from two deputies covering 4,500 square miles to jurisdictions going in and out of tribal communities. It's a daunting task, and the men and women that are doing this work have substantial challenges, and in some cases beyond the understanding of most. This week's hearings will truly be eye-opening for the commissioners, working group members, staff, and the media on the call. This time I'll ask our Executive Director, Dean Keeter, to conduct a roll call of commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before we get started today, I'd just like to remind everybody that the event is open to the press. And for any members of the media on the call, if you have any questions or need clarification on anything, please contact Christina Master-Pasqua in the Justice Department's Office of Public Affairs. And with that, I'll call the roll. Commissioner Bowditch.
You'll be here momentarily.
Commissioner Clemens.
Here.
Commissioner Evans.
Here.
Commissioner Frazier. Commissioner Galtieri. Commissioner Hawkins.
I'm here, thank you.
Commissioner Lombardo.
I'm here, thank you.
Commissioner McDonald.
Good afternoon, present.
Commissioner Moody.
I'm here, thank you.
Commissioner Parr.
I'm here.
Commissioner Price.
Good afternoon, I'm here.
Commissioner Ramsey.
Here.
Commissioner Roush.
I'm here.
Commissioner Samaniego.
I'm here.
Commissioner Smallwood.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Sullivan.
I'm here. Thank you.
And Commissioner Washington.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes the roll call.
Hey, Dean, this is Frazier. I'm on here.
Great. Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Any other announcements, Dean?
No, sir. We are good to go.
Thank you. All commissioners should have the bios and testimony for this panel. And as a reminder, we'll be posting all these materials on the Law Enforcement Commission website. Once again, we continue to acknowledge everyone's commitment, efforts, and contributions to meet the goals of this historic commission. And on behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank each of you. As noted on previous calls, we encourage commissioners to take notes during the testimony of the panelists, and we will then open for questions from commissioners after the last witness. Our first distinguished panelist is Mr. Ron Parsons, who is the United States Attorney for South Dakota. I've had the pleasure of working very closely with the U.S. Attorney Parsons, and I'm pleased that he can join us here today. He's a dedicated public servant and tremendous advocate for law enforcement throughout the state of South Dakota, including 9 Indian reservations. Thank you for joining us. Mr. Parsons, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Keith, Vice Chair Sullivan, and members of the commission. It's a privilege to appear before you and be able to provide some perspective on rural and tribal America. We were lucky to host Chairman Keith at our Joint Sheriffs and Police Chiefs Conference in Deadwood, South Dakota, historic Deadwood, last year. And so it's very pleasant to be talking with him again. I've also had the opportunity to work with Vice Chair Sullivan on many projects over the years, and so I wanted to say hello to you, Katie, as well. And I should recognize my friend and neighbor to the east, U.S. Attorney McDonald. It's good to be with you, Erica. But I'm most proud to recognize my friend Craig Price, who's the Secretary of the South Dakota Department of Public Safety and is a member of your commission. I have a chance to work with Craig very closely on public safety and law enforcement issues in South Dakota over the years. Great to be in front of you. I have am the 42nd United States Attorney for the District of South Dakota. We're a rural state primarily. We have one city. Some might not even say it qualifies as a city, but Sioux Falls, South Dakota, a mid-sized city in the southeast corner of the state. The rest of the state is primarily agricultural, rural, ranching territory, and then we have the Badlands and mountains out west, the Black Hills. And our state includes 9 Indian reservations with whom we at the U.S. Attorney's Office work very closely with our tribal partners. And those reservations are located throughout the state. Before I joined the Department of Justice, I worked in private practice in South Dakota for my entire career with the same law firm and represented people from all walks of life in South Dakota, ranchers, farmers, school districts, county governments, law enforcement officials, businesses, large and small. I represented the state of South Dakota itself, and I represented federally recognized Indian tribes. I believe I have a breadth of experience on what's happening on the ground, at least in the Great Plains, in terms of law enforcement and in terms of what our needs are. We're a small state in terms of population, but we're geographically large. And while a lot of us are collected in the southeast corner of the state, the rest of the state is very widely scattered. We struggle sometimes to keep people in the counties where they were raised. It's a struggle for people to remain close to home. We're seeing some success in bringing people back, but the lack of population, the lack of a tax base, and the lack of resources affects us greatly, and that's no more true than in the area of law enforcement. But if I had to summarize what the greatest problem is in rural South Dakota, greatest crime problem, I could do it in one word. That is methamphetamine. In some parts of the country, opioids are the main problem, the main drug problem, the main crime problem. In here, in South Dakota and in rural America, in the Great Plains at least, methamphetamine is by far our greatest problem facing society and facing law enforcement. Nearly every serious crime that's committed in South Dakota has some connection to methamphetamine, whether you're talking about aggravated assaults or domestic violence or sexual abuse, child abuse or neglect that are committed by people under the influence of meth or other drugs, or robberies, burglaries, fraud, and embezzlement that are done in order to get money to purchase meth, or drug trafficking itself and the violence and the gun crime that's almost always associated with it. When you scratch the surface of a crime in South Dakota, and I think most of the Midwest, you're likely to find the residue of meth. And we know that almost all the meth is coming from Mexico and Central America, manufactured there, smuggled across our borders, and then distributed throughout our state and throughout the Indian reservations located within our state by local networks connected to the cartels. We need money for treatment. We need money for prevention in rural America. But if we could do one thing that would immediately improve the lives of every man, woman, and child in the state of South Dakota, it would be to eliminate the source of meth, to dismantle the drug trafficking cartels, and prevent that poison from coming into our communities. And that's the main message I wanted to send. Nothing dominates law enforcement experience more in South Dakota, and I think a lot of rural America, than methamphetamine trafficking. In my experience, the second largest source of illegal drugs in rural America is the United States Postal Service. Many of the drug trafficking prosecutions we have a connection to the U.S. mails. People get on the internet or the dark web and order heroin or fentanyl or prescription pills from China or other places in the world, other places in the United States, and it comes in through the mail. And yet in South Dakota, which is a geographically immense state, we only have, I think, two postal inspectors assigned to cover the entire state, one on the eastern side of the Missouri River and one on the western side. In my view, increasing the number of postal inspectors would have a profound effect, an impact on law enforcement's ability to combat the drug problem here in South Dakota, and I suspect most of rural America. The tax base and the lack of resources affect law enforcement greatly all across the state of South Dakota, whether you're talking about county police forces, city police forces, or county sheriff's departments, or tribal police forces. All of them lack adequate resources. They lack adequate personnel. They lack adequate training and equipment. And they lack adequate jail or detention space. What we've been forced to do as much as we can is try to pool our resources between governmental entities. And that can work very well. You know, a cop is a cop. Law enforcement is a family. And when different law enforcement agencies work together, that's when we see the best results. We're forced to do that here in rural America, including Indian Country. And when we do that, we can see great success. So one of the recommendations I wanted to urge in particular was anything that can be done to allow us to bridge divides between law enforcement agencies, make it easier for us to work together, I think ought to be on the table and ought to be considered. A good example of that is a recent agreement, a historic agreement in South Dakota between the South Dakota Highway Patrol and the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe. And Commissioner Price was directly involved in this, but the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe and the Highway Patrol entered a memorandum of understanding where the Highway Patrol would assist in the policing of the Crow Creek Tribe's annual powwow, which is a major event in central South Dakota, right alongside tribal officers working hand in hand to enforce tribal law on the reservation. And anything that began to encourage those types of relationships and the pooling of resources, force multipliers, I'm all in favor of, and I think we all are. Another good example of a state-federal partnership I really wanted to highlight as a best practice, because it saves us so much time and money in the state of South Dakota in terms of federal prosecutions, is the partnership that was created between the FBI lab and our state, between the Federal Bureau of Investigation and our state forensic laboratory. We were seeing in sexual assault cases and other cases where DNA was incredibly important, an average wait time of between 9 months and a year to get test results back. And that was unacceptable to us in South Dakota. So the FBI engaged in a partnership with the state forensic laboratory. It's one of only a few such relationships in the country. I think Arizona has another one. And we were able to reduce the wait time for lab results from about 9 months to a year to about a month. And few things have had more of a profound impact for victims in South Dakota than that arrangement. So my overall message is we need to do everything we can to increase resources, but where resources can't be increased, to break down barriers to allow us to work together. Because when we work together, things happen. I would say, as the COVID-19 pandemic arose and people began to take precautions to respond to the disease, there was an internet meme that appeared in our corner of the world that featured some of our beautiful wide-open spaces here in this part of the country with the caption, South Dakota, social distancing since 1889. It's an ironic, though, that in a rural setting, the distances between homes and communities somehow do seem to bring us close together. And I've heard friends of mine who have moved to larger urban areas remark about feeling isolated and alone in the middle of a bustling crowd. Really, it's just a matter, distance is a matter of perspective, and distances can be bridged and traversed, and people of all types can be connected. And really, that's what law enforcement is about, protecting everyone together. So I want to thank you for allowing me to relay my perspective today, and I want to thank President Trump, Attorney General Barr, for allowing your work to be done. And I'm eager to take any of your questions when we move on to that section of the program. Thank you.
And thank you, U.S. Attorney Parsons, for your commitment and certainly the service to law enforcement and for your valued testimony here today. Our next distinguished panelist is Chief Michael Keller, who is the police chief of Andover, Kansas. Chief Keller has had an extraordinary law enforcement career and has been the recipient of 3 bronze wreaths for valor and 2 bronze wreaths from merit for his act of dedication and bravery. He was also the recipient of the 2015 Officer of the Year Award. He serves on a number of boards and associations, including the president of the Kansas Association of Chiefs of Police, and is the Kansas representative for the State Associations of Chiefs of Police for the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Chief Keller, thank you for joining us today. You're recognized.
Thank you, Director Keith. Thank you, Vice Chair Solomon, and thank you, Commissioners. Before I begin, I want to take an opportunity to recognize Commissioner Ramsey. I had the opportunity to attend the National Academy Session 222 in 2005 with then Lieutenant Ramsey. And then for the last several years, I've had the opportunity to work closely with Chief Ramsey, as he's the chief of our neighboring agency, the Wichita Police Department. Commissioners, it is truly an honor and privilege to be speaking with you. Much of what I'm going to say about the challenges in rural law enforcement faces, you have already heard. There will be no surprises today. Therefore, in respect of your time, I'm going to be as brief as possible, emphasizing a few points, and refer you to my written testimony for additional details. And at the end, I'll make a few recommendations. As Director Keith indicated, my name is Michael Keller, and I have been in law enforcement for over 40 years. I started my career in 1977 as a reserve officer in a small 12-member department before joining the Wichita Police Department in 1979. The Wichita Police Department is the single largest law enforcement agency in the state of Kansas. I retired from Wichita in 1999 after almost 21 years of service, and now have been a chief of police for a small rural-type agency for over 18 years. I highlight this part of my resume because I believe it's important to demonstrate that I have experienced and have seen the issues and challenges in law enforcement, both from the large agency perspective as well as from the smaller rural agency. All law enforcement agencies have unique challenges, individualized to their local agency and their respective communities. And then there are some significant law enforcement challenges that all our agencies face, and both large and small. But as you heard last week from Sheriff William Bruggeman from Nebraska, small rural law enforcement agencies generally have many of the exact same issues and challenges that the larger agencies have. We're all dealing with drugs, dealing with mental health issues, recruitment and retention problems, technology needs, training. But one of the significant constant differences in the small rural agencies is generally they do not have the funding and resources available like the larger agencies have to deal with these same challenges. In 2019, under the guidance of Director Keith, and Director Keith spoke about earlier, the COPS office conducted a listening tour with rural law enforcement leaders in five states, South Dakota, Oklahoma, Utah, Iowa, and Montana. The purpose was to find out what the challenges rural law enforcement agencies face, and they published their findings in a study titled Concerns of Rural Law Enforcement, What We Heard from the Field. This study confirmed that rural law enforcement agencies share many of the same top issues and challenges that the larger agencies and communities have. However, as Sheriff Bruggelman pointed out last week, often they don't have the funding or resources to deal with those issues. The study also found that four of the top issues were for the rural agencies were the increase of opioid and methamphetamine use, as your previous speaker talked about, basically drug use, recruitment and retention problems, expense of technology. These are things like body-worn cameras, mobile computers, automated license plate readers, and the list goes on. And number four, the lack of resources for dealing with mental health issues. Earlier this year, I, after being asked to be a part of the Rural and Tribal Law Enforcement Working Group under this commission, I took it upon myself to survey about 20 rural police chiefs in Kansas and ask them very similar questions. What I found, again, was no surprise that the rural law enforcement agencies in Kansas share many of the same issues and challenges of their peers from the other states. Recruitment and hiring. It is difficult to compete. It is difficult for our small agencies to compete with the larger agencies on salaries, benefits, and promotional opportunities or assignment opportunities. Number two, mental health resources. One rural city in Kansas reported a 61% increase on mental health-related calls in 2019 from the prior year. Number three, drugs, has been mentioned. The legalization of marijuana, the opioid epidemic, and the methamphetamine use. Number four, inadequate funding for additional staffing, technology advancements, and training. And number five, a big one, the lack of quality training for their officers. In my written testimony, I broke the most challenging issues for the smaller agencies into four critical areas and provided details on the challenges as well as some promising practices. These challenging areas that are the same as was pointed out by the COPS office study and by Sheriff Bruggelman last week include inadequate funding, lack of resources, mental health issues, and the lack of resources, recruitment, hiring, and retention, and again, the lack of quality training for our officers in the rural areas. Rather than go through each of the four challenging areas individually and repeat things that you've already heard, I'm going to go straight to my recommendations. Number one, considering that about half of our law enforcement agencies in the United States have fewer than 10 officers, and approximately 70% of our agencies serve communities of less than 10,000 people, I recommend that federal grant applications, eligibility criteria, and factors determining the awards for these grants to be retooled so that the final allocation of federal grant funds are fairly and proportionally distributed between the large agencies and small rural agencies alike. Number two, considering that the smaller rural agencies are dealing with mental health issues at the same rate of the larger agencies, but without the resources to deal with them, I recommend that additional resources be specifically directed to the small rural agencies for the purpose of dealing with the mentally ill, including a mandate for or at least a strong encouragement that all law enforcement officers receive critical incident training, or CIT training, or at a very minimum, mental health response training for all officers. Number three, considering that the smaller rural agencies cannot compete with the larger agency in salaries, benefits, and advancement opportunities, I recommend that a federally funded grant program be established, similar to the doctors and teachers programs that are already in existence, to attract and retain quality police officers in rural communities through hiring bonuses and/or student loan forgiveness programs. Number four, considering that one of the top challenges facing the small rural agency is obtaining quality training for our officers, I recommend that national, regional policing training centers in each of the 10 Homeland Security regions be established and properly funded, similar to what is currently being done in the state of Kansas, with the single mission of meeting the unique and challenging needs of the small rural law enforcement agency. And finally, my last one, number five, to also assist with the issue of the lack of quality training for our small agencies, I recommend that the selection process for the federal training opportunities, such as the FBI's National Academy, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, or FLETC, and Homeland Security Centers for Domestic Preparedness be retooled to ensure that the small rural agencies receive a fair and proportionate number of these training opportunities. That concludes my remarks and recommendations. Thank you again for this opportunity to address this commission, and I'll stand for questions following the other speakers. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Keller, for your valued testimony today and for your leadership to law enforcement in our country for over four decades. Our next distinguished panelist is Chief John Letney from Apex, North Carolina. Chief Letney has been the chief of Apex since 2012, having nearly four decades of law enforcement experience. He's currently the third vice president for IACP, as well as a valued member of our Respect for Law Enforcement and Rule of Law Working Group. He's a master's in public administration and is a graduate of the FBI National Academy. Chief Letney, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Keith. Good afternoon, everyone. Chairman Keith, Vice Chair Sullivan, Director Keeter, all our working group members, and certainly our commissioners, thank you for the opportunity to provide this testimony for consideration as the commission, through the Rural and Tribal Law Enforcement Working Group, develops recommendations to improve law enforcement and the administration of justice. I will not go through my entire background and resume. You have it, but you see I have experience in urban areas, suburban areas, and rural areas. And through this experience, I've seen the opportunities and challenges of providing effective, efficient, and professional law enforcement services. I hope that I bring a perspective that balances those different areas and experiences and cross-pollinates the ideas and best practices learned from one area to another, as I think law enforcement is unique and very diverse. We can all learn from the experiences of different areas and different agency types. There is a variety of styles, there's a variety of service delivery methods, and there is no one-size-fits-all or best way to engage our communities. The skills, the staffing, the access to supervisors and so on can be very limited in small and rural areas, as can be the differences in community expectations, in public safety issues, and in engagement methods. Yet, as you've heard, training is often very generic and not community specific. So I will briefly discuss seven basic areas of challenges and how they disproportionately affect smaller, rural, and even tribal agencies. There is much more detail in my written testimony already provided. You will find that what I have to bring to the table is very similar to what you heard from Chief Keller and previous comments as well. Law enforcement agencies serving in rural areas generally fall into just a few categories. There are statewide agencies, such as state police. There are county agencies, such as county police or county sheriff, and there are certainly smaller local municipal-type agencies. For example, in North Carolina, approximately 300 of the 515 municipal law enforcement agencies are rural in nature with less than 20 officers. Several have fewer than 10. And since every municipality, no matter how small, is responsible for providing law enforcement services, some have a total sworn staff of one, and that would be the chief. There are 100 sheriff's offices, one in each county, and two county or metro police agencies. Most law enforcement in our state, like most states, can be classified as small or rural. And not all of these challenges are faced by all agencies, but there are common themes when providing service in these rural areas. I'll start with technology and connectivity. Cell phone and internet in rural areas is generally less reliable, less available, and more costly than urban areas. And so much of modern police work relies on this good information flow and access to systems and databases. Our computer-aided dispatch systems, our records management systems are generally individual. They don't integrate. They require support and are expensive. So many smaller agencies don't have modern systems at all. So their functions are less efficient, and the reporting of data like UCR or NIBRS may be lacking. So in this area, I would recommend that technology providers develop needed infrastructure through grants or other incentives so the rural areas can take advantage of these efficiencies and opportunities. Continue to develop the FirstNet system as a cost-effective way for all agencies to communicate, and encourage a systems approach to CAD and RMS so that multi-agency, regional, or statewide solutions can be developed, implemented, and supported regardless of agency size or vendor. Rural agencies also don't have necessary or up-to-date equipment. Generally, this is related to funding, but it may also be related to lack of personnel or expertise to adequately research, test, develop policy, and implement new technologies or equipment. So as a recommendation, I think we should develop research assistant programs, publish leading practices for specific equipment implementation and replacement, provide funding assistance, of course, and work with professional associations to further develop and distribute leading practices. Speaking of funding, most small agencies compete for scarce resources with other important government services. In most states, law enforcement doesn't provide revenue. In those states that allow revenue, there is significant concern from communities about policing for profit rather than the altruistic goal of public safety. Elected or appointed officials may put pressure on police chiefs, command staff, or officers to increase traffic enforcement to address budget needs. And I'm aware of at least one state that encouraged law enforcement agencies to increase enforcement of vehicle registration laws because their renewals and therefore their funding had been reduced. Mandates for annual training, certain services or equipment that are required to be provided are often unfunded and leave these agencies scrambling for how to comply with those mandates within their existing budget. Grant programs, as you heard, are highly competitive, and only a small percentage are available or awarded to smaller rural agencies. Even then, many cannot meet matching fund requirements or don't have the staff to actually manage or meet the reporting requirements. Rural agencies need funding for basic police things, not specific programs per se. They need police personnel, vehicles, equipment, and training. So existing grant programs, to use Chief Keller's term, should be retooled and focused on smaller rural agencies. Non-law enforcement support services are also a significant problem across our profession. Police officers are called to many situations that are beyond the scope of traditional law enforcement. While certainly willing to serve and solve problems, police officers are not always best suited to effectively address all situations. But they're called because no other system effectively addresses these underlying issues. Rural communities don't have the resources or diversion programs, and this affects tribal agencies as well, as the IACP Indian Country Section has made this a topic for priority of their research. For example, in one rural North Carolina county, area chiefs report they don't have adequate mental health care options. Many officers are certified in crisis intervention team, the CIT model, but they don't have the proper referral organizations to provide treatment for consumers. In other areas, agencies just don't have the training time, the staffing, or the funding to take advantage of the CIT program, or may not have policy guiding the interaction with mental health consumers. Homelessness, food security, drug treatment, and basic social services are not universally available, resulting in either additional acts that might be crimes that could be avoided if needed assistance were provided, or the fact that without another solution, the criminal justice system is used because people can't access other more appropriate systems. So we should be enhancing the ability of social service and mental health providers to address the needs in their community. They should be responders like we are and should be accessed maybe through a 911 system, so they can most appropriately respond as they are called to assist. In policy, staffing, training, and some limited expertise may result in smaller agencies who don't have the time, staff, or expertise to develop policies to give proper guidance. Through the Collaborative Reform Initiative Technical Assistance Center, or CRITAC, through IACP's Model Policy Center, through the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies and perhaps other member associations, there are opportunities available, but some are not cost-effective and some are just not well advertised. Our North Carolina League of Municipalities, as a member-driven organization and insurer, provides a risk liability and certification program specifically tailored to smaller law enforcement agencies, which may help and serve as a model in other states as well. Recommendation there would be to develop a toolkit of available services and advertise those benefits. Staffing, you've heard about BJA reported that 7% of officers separated from agencies overall in one recent study, but the rate in agencies with smaller staffing under 10 officers was 4 times the rate of larger agencies. There are several staffing issues that could be helped with the recommendations you've already heard. And while I have some recommendations on training education, you have heard them as well, and I will not belabor that point. I'll refer you to my final recommendations for that. And I would add that through state associations and the IACP, new chief mentoring programs, new chief training programs should be researched, reinforced, and grant funded so that they can be made available to enhance our leadership development throughout our profession. Issues that affect rural law enforcement affect all of our profession and our communities. While often attributed to former President John F. Kennedy, but which originated in an economic conversation with the New England Council, which is a chamber of commerce, the phrase, a rising tide floats all boats, applicable to the law enforcement profession as well. If we invest in and support our rural and tribal agencies, our profession as a whole will improve and our communities will benefit. Once again, thank you for the opportunity to provide this testimony, and that concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Chief Letney, for your valued testimony, and certainly for your service to law enforcement. Our last distinguished panelist today is Ms. Cheryl Bogue, State's Attorney in rural Zeebach and Carson counties in South Dakota. She is most familiar with the challenges in the face rural communities, particularly as they relate to prosecutors. She serves on a variety of boards and task forces and practices law in state, local, tribal, and federal courts. State's Attorney Bogue, thank you for joining us today. You're recognized.
Thank you, Director Keith. Good afternoon to commission members, and I thank you for the opportunity to address the Honorable Commission. This is a very important matter and a day-to-day struggle for those of us located in the rural communities. I would reiterate the comments from the previous speakers, and especially U.S. Attorney Ron Parsons, who has very generously worked closely with most local prosecutors in the state of South Dakota and definitely the sheriffs and individual chief of police. As stated previously, Zeebach and Carson County are about as rural as you can get. One of the biggest issues that we've had that I've observed over my 29 and a half years of being a state's attorney out here is that we are so rural, we must travel great distances, not only to treatment facilities or transport prisoners to a regional jail facility, but also just for backup. One of the most critical issues that we have is substance abuse, as stated previously, methamphetamine definitely in our rural communities, but also especially on the nine Indian reservations. I am a lifelong resident of the Cheyenne River Indian Reservation. I was born and raised just outside of Eagle Butte. My sheriff is my kindergarten through high school graduation classmate. I've known him literally my whole life. His mother is a retired tribal judge for the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. And we are all very interconnected here. I state that because my comments predominantly echo everyone else's. We need more funding. We need more funding for facilities. We need more funding for treatment. We need more funding for equipment, testing, training, and especially more boots on the ground, as we would say. Several years past, the BIA, which performs the law enforcement for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, had what they called a surge, and they brought in BIA officers and other officers from other areas of the country and really crack down on crime at Standing Rock, and it made a tremendous difference. Until that time, I don't think it was very clear to all of us in our rural area just what a difference additional manpower can make. I've seen my sheriff's department in Zeebah County grow from one sheriff elected and a part-time deputy to one full-time deputy and one part-time deputy who's also a school liaison police officer. And we have struggled each time to be able to scrape together the resources to hire. It is a tremendous problem. Zeebah County in the past has utilized the COP grants, as many other local communities have. I wish to speak to that specifically. Funding obtained through the federal system for personnel is usually very limited in time period, specifically 3 years. At that end of the 3 years, then a jurisdiction is faced with either letting go the needed personnel or trying to figure out another funding source, and there just isn't any. And so I would encourage a retooling, as has been stated before, with approach to personnel grants. I would extend that period of time out, either to address significantly the issue at hand or to be able to give enough time to the funding agency that they could be able to have funding available locally. I will also tell you, though, I don't think that that's really a possibility for our area. The reservations themselves either have a BIA law enforcement or they have a 638 contract and perform those duties normally performed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs themselves. For Cheyenne River, that means they have 15 officers for the whole reservation, which is all of Dewey and Zeebah County. In my comments, I think I've stated that we have 11,000 approximately enrolled tribal members living at Cheyenne River. The availability for backup in our very rural communities is almost non-existent. As a result, both the tribal law enforcement and the sheriff's office and city police work very closely together. It is always very reassuring and is a great source of pride for all of us that all of our brothers and sisters in blue support one another. They are always on call, whether they are or not being paid to do so. They're always on call and come immediately to the assistance. Greatest difference is you may wait 20 minutes for backup. And that can be incredibly dangerous because we have not just our local people anymore in our community that are committing crime. We have people from the outside, namely bringing in drugs, mulling in drugs. We've had a very sharp increase in drug use across the board, specifically methamphetamine. It has increased domestic calls dramatically, property crime, violent crime. We went from having, when I first started, an occasional assault where we have murders. We have violent assaults. We have unsolved murders that happen on a regular occurrence. And it is quite frightening for the people in our community. We still see ourselves as a very small and safe community, but the fact is, it really is not. And those issues will have to be addressed in order for things to go back to the way they should be in a small community. I would also like to state that I have contacted both tribal law enforcement and some of our rural agencies in the area that we work with all the time and ask them exactly those type of things that are would be needed. What is most gratifying is that they do not expect that there would be federal funding for each individual agency, which might end up being redundant and wasteful. They do highly encourage that we increase funding for a regional approach. Right now, we have the Safe Trails Task Force in our area. We have several of our officers on that from Corson and Zeebah County on the task force, and they travel from community to community. They receive specialized training, and they assist local law enforcement. Increasing the funding to a regional approach would be very helpful, especially in the areas of regional jail facilities. Right now, Zeebah County transports prisoners 120 miles one way to house them in a jail. The JDC is located about 145 miles away, or 106 one way. It is incredibly difficult and very expensive for the county to house prisoners. We still have the need to house people. We just have to figure out how to make the mileage work. We are a consortium of counties are coming together and trying to find the money to build a new facility or to rehab an existing one in one county. However, that price tag is extremely high. As you know, building facilities is very expensive. And it would also be very difficult to manage. Basically, they'd be contracting with the one county that's going to build it with a serious financial commitment from each county. That's very problematic on just a strictly accounting process. I would also encourage the commission to consider funding regional mental health facilities and or treatment. As we have found, substance abuse is very closely tied to the issues of poverty, but especially mental illness. And it becomes a very tight revolving circle of substance abuse and mental psychoses that require inpatient treatment. We do not have any facility at local. We must transport everyone to Rapid City Regional or in Corson County to Bismarck, which is approximately 80 miles away from the county seat. Those facilities are limited beds, and oftentimes the individual is back out into the community without significant treatment. They go back to their normal behaviors, which ended up having them cross paths with law enforcement. And so it'd be very critical and very forward-thinking to address mental health in a very comprehensive manner. I had written comments, and it is not surprising that they all mimic the other speakers. We all need funding in our rural areas. I would like to basically state that in our area on the reservation, we have 88% permanent unemployment. We have generational poverty. Very little, if any, economic development in our area. And so the lack of infrastructure creates a dramatic problem with the youth. There really is no hope. And when there's no hope, you're going to fall into patterns of lawlessness and substance abuse. Federal funding to address a stabilization of the crime and the drug use in our area would greatly enhance the ability to attract businesses to the area. We do have businesses that wish to locate in our area. We have a very youthful and appreciative law, or excuse me, employment base, but you can't convince anybody to move into an area where we have a high crime rate that is not addressed. And so those issues would be greatly helped, not just for non-Indians, but for every enrolled tribal member at Cheyenne River and Standing Rock Indian Reservations. And this would be true of all the Indian reservations in our state. I will reserve the rest of my comments to response to questions if there are any. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the commission, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your service, Ms. Bug, and your leadership and valued testimony here today. Commissioners, we are now open for questions for the witnesses. Commissioners with a question, please state your name prior to your question and direct the question to a specific panelist or the entire panel. Just as a reminder to the commissioners, your mics are hot at all times. Thank you. With that, commissioners with questions for our panelists.
Mr. Keith, it's Craig Price.
Yes, you're recognized.
We appreciate everybody's time, and I feel a real strong connection with the panelists today for all the reasons stated. Appreciate their input and perspective, and I don't really have a lot to add because they covered it so well as far as the issues and the concerns and recommendations that we have here in Middle America. The one thing that I would add is that having been, you know, the superintendent of the Highway Patrol for 8.5 years, Very early on in my tenure, we made a commitment that whenever an officer from any department, whether it be tribal, BIA, federal, local, BD, SO, whatever, if there's a call for assistance and they need additional law enforcement resources, we're going to respond. And the state stepped up and said that they're going to be there with us in the event that something goes sideways. And I think there's a real concern for the line level officers out there that are responding to these violent issues that are happening where they don't have jurisdiction. And if there's something that the commission can do working with folks that would have some input and maybe some solutions to that, I think that it would only enhance the relationships that already exist, because out here, if you don't have, you know, the general public doesn't care what uniform you wear, they don't care what badge you have on your chest. When they need help, they expect somebody to show up and help them out, and there's just not enough resources to go around. So the better ways that we can work together and offer that support and really have those officers covered when they're working in different jurisdictions would be a significant benefit and impact to help further those relationships and cover those instances that come up where a large number of law enforcement resources might be needed. U.S. Attorney Parsons talked about the MOU that we have with Crow Creek, and that not only works at the powwow, but it works throughout the year whenever there's an issue or a crime happening on the reservation and they need troopers to come and help. It takes one call to the tribal chairman to authorize that, and those officers are responding under the authority of that MOU, and they're covered for those issues that might arise from them having to use force where there might be tort claims or whatever that comes as a result of an issue that they deal with while they're on the reservation. So I would just add that component to the already excellent testimony by the other folks that run the panel. So I thank you all for your time and appreciate the opportunity to comment on that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Other commissioners? Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
This is a question for Mr. Parsons. Mr. Parsons, you mentioned there at the very end of your testimony about the reduction in time that you were able to have with your items that are sent to the forensic lab. Could you talk a little bit about how that agreement was reached and how that, because that's a huge reduction from about a year to a month for waiting for analysis to come back. So I would appreciate it if you could just talk about that for a second.
Sure, and I do want to say that this is the wait time is an issue that the Department of Justice has been working on over the last year or two. I was also a member of a working group to try to get overall wait times reduced, and we have already adopted, I think the Department of Justice and the FBI has adopted streamlining and ways to prioritize testing. So this is an issue that a lot of people have been working on with some success already. But it was really, as I said, born out of necessity, and I wasn't at the U.S. Attorney's Office at the time, but primarily we have, of course, general felony jurisdiction on Indian reservations, so we have to deal with every sexual assault, every child abuse case, and we need quick DNA, and it was just unacceptable. And so I credit FBI leadership in the air, in this region, Bob Perry, who essentially is the top agent for both of the Dakotas out of the Minneapolis division of the FBI, got together with our state government. Craig Price might have been there too when this was happening, and really decided, hey, we can provide a certain amount of funding to you, to the state lab. That allowed the state lab to really get up and running, get the equipment it needed and the personnel it needed, in exchange for a commitment that you'll take all of our testing for South Dakota that we need you to take. And it worked so well that every, I think, test now goes to the South Dakota State Forensic Lab that we have in a federal case arising in Indian Country in South Dakota, rather than to the FBI lab. Arizona, I know, has a similar agreement in place. And of course, by taking those out of the queue, that also helps to reduce the wait time for all the other districts. So one of the things in being on that task force, I wanted to make sure is that this model was protected because it works so well for us. And I think it ought to be available on a regional basis or a district basis to have quicker testing. And it also helps us with at trials. A South Dakota jury is going to relate a lot more to a South Dakota doctor from the state lab who's available to get to trial on a moment's notice, doesn't have to jump on a plane and deal with the scheduling that all the lab technicians do at the national laboratory. So I think it's just a great system. It just proves one size does not fit all, and where this could be implemented, I'm all for it. We love it.
Thank you very much.
Other commissioners with questions?
Bill, this is Erica McDonald. May I ask a couple of questions?
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
Okay, the first question I have, Ron, thank you so much for your testimony. I really appreciate all the panelists. My question is directed towards Ron. You know, like South Dakota and Minnesota here, we're just awash in mess. And especially in our rural areas, our outstate metro, it's incomprehensible the amount of meth that is flowing, and the source of all problems does relate to meth in many of our jurisdictions. When it comes to our resources that we have in Indian country and the drug problem they're facing, you know, co-committing with the issues that have always been there with violent crime, can you speak to the resources that we have, the federal resources, and whether we can make recommendations as to increasing resources for, you know, DEA presence, FBI presence, BIA, to address the meth problem that we have?
Yeah, my friend Cheryl Bogue mentioned, if it weren't for the drug task forces, we would be in a lot bigger trouble. The way it works in South Dakota, we have the Sioux Falls Area Drug Task Force, which is the larger metropolitan area in the state, really the only metropolitan area, and federal, state, county, city law enforcement all serve on that. When we're talking about the rest of the state, we have two Northern Plains Safe Trails task forces, one in the Pier area, which also services about five or six of the Indian reservations located more in the central part of the state, and then one in the western, in the Black Hills, which services the entire Black Hills as well as the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. The funding, and the FBI runs those latter two task forces. If we did not have those and the federal dollars that help to support those, we would not be able to do virtually any large-scale drug trafficking investigation. And so, as State's Attorney Bogue mentioned, local sheriffs serve on these task forces as well, deputy sheriffs, state DCI investigators. So the promotion of these task forces, where we're pooling our resources, pooling our information, pooling our talent, that's the only model that works in this part of the country. And if we could have five task forces instead of three, I would take it. We have a need for it. But thank God we have three.
And that was going to be my follow-up question. Based on your work, you serve on the subcommittee, the Native American Issues Subcommittee for the Attorney General's Advisory Committee. And based on your work with NAIS, do you believe there's adequate resources for rural, or do you think that we should be speaking to our federal agencies and seeing about an allocation of resources that would better cover our rural and tribal areas?
No, there is a sorely inadequate. It's terribly inadequate. And there's duplication of agencies. There are really no DEA agents dedicated to Indian country, at least in South Dakota, really up to the FBI, the tribal police, and the local sheriffs and the state DCI. So we need more DEA agents. We need more postal inspectors who also serve on our drug task forces where they're available. But we only have two. With all the mail that's coming in with marijuana and heroin and meth and prescription opioids hidden in the mail, we need more of everything. BIA is underfunded. FBI is underfunded in terms of manpower in this part of the state. Everyone is. So we need more of everything. And I hate to sound like a broken record, but that's true. And it'll keep being true until we get more resources.
I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you very much. And then, Phil, if it's all right, I have one more question for all the panelists. Consistent with Ron's testimony regarding the Postal Service and it being kind of an, frankly, an unwitting dupe in the amount of drugs that it's delivering into our communities, does anybody have any creative recommendations or creative solutions to how we could work with Postal and our other private carriers to eliminate this problem? And I know that more postal inspectors would be good, but we need another solution to how we can prevent drugs from flowing in, especially from China in the dark web, and having our mail delivery systems, you know, really be part of the conspiracy.
Well, this is John Lenny. I'll jump in. Thank you for that question. And I agree 100% that there is a need for more resources in a variety of ways, but certainly to combat the drug problem. In our area, my canine unit is used fairly regularly to go to post offices, postal distribution centers, private carrier distribution centers when there's suspicion about a certain package. And it is not uncommon that in searching one, we find a dozen more where the dog hits on it. Many times the postal inspectors will find packages that are suspicious to them for a variety of reasons. My understanding, and I think the U.S. attorneys could talk more about this, but the regulations around what gives them cause to call in for a sniff or to actually take a package off the line and open it are very restrictive, and it's only done with certain weights or certain types. So there is so much more getting through just because it flies under the radar. But perhaps looking at the process and making some adjustments to what it would take to really have a more concentrated focus would be helpful. And, of course, that takes more resources, more collaboration, more task forces. And that, at least from a local perspective, those relationships are in place. So we would be ready and willing to help. We just need more calls and then more ability to further those investigations to the point where we can actually hopefully develop probable cause and hold someone accountable.
Thank you. Other commissioners with questions?
Director Keith, this is Dave Roush.
Yes, sir, you're recognized.
Thank you. I actually want to offer up an idea on that concept that Commissioner McDonald asked about, and that is, you know, when 9/11 happened, our air system completely changed. TSA was created to check every individual that travels. So why couldn't we do the same thing with packages? I don't know anything more terroristic than the drug problem that we have. Methamphetamine is absolutely become king in the state of Tennessee, and I'm sure as I hear elsewhere. And so, you know, my question is, why can't we create a TSA for packages where every package is screened that comes into this country, that's moving throughout this country, just as people are screened? And then that way it closes that down as an option. That's my suggestion. We've been told to think outside the box on this thing. I think there may be an opportunity there.
Thank you, Commissioner. Other commissioners with questions or comments?
Chairman Keith, this is Katie Sullivan.
You're recognized, Commissioner.
Thank you. So this could be for any one of the panelists. Great to hear all of you, of course. Thank you, Ron. I hope you're doing well in South Dakota. I wanted to talk about the fact that there's a big move right now by the federal government for telehealth and getting broadband out to underserved communities, including rural. And this initiative really is coming from the White House for Opportunity Zone Revitalization. And I'm wondering, it's so focused on health. And when I ever get the opportunity to sit in the meetings, I try to remind them that we can use these for public safety access as well. Is there a way that you think that public safety, police officers, law enforcement agencies, and rural communities can work with their health partners to combine or share tele type of services.
Hi, Katie,
this is any commissioner that wants to answer, and if it was confusing, I apologize.
This is Ron Parsons. Thanks for the question, Katie. Crime analysis and crime analysts are something that I think is feasible in terms of telework and help from federal partners, help from people in other places. And so I think we have some exporting of intelligence analysis by our drug task forces, but that is something that comes to mind that would work. When you're talking about boots on the ground, teleboots don't work, unfortunately. So I'm struggling to think of some other areas where we could use those resources.
Well, you guys had brought up the mental health and substance abuse issues, and also, like, just thinking about Alaska, for instance, if they have a great telehealth program to get up to the very rural communities in Alaska, and our thought was that maybe, you know, a police officer could do an interview by, you know, a kiosk or some kind of way by FaceTime or like we're all doing now during COVID. They can take pictures potentially and preserve some evidence, which might otherwise not be preserved because of the time it takes to get somewhere geographically. So I don't know. I just know that there's a big push right now by the federal government to expand broadband and these telehealth services. So didn't know if there was a way that we could think of a recommendation that might combine some of the things and issues that all of you are struggling with.
No, I think those are great ideas. That's definitely worth studying. And cell coverage is a problem in some parts of South Dakota, though we are working hard. Our senators are working hard to try to get us 5G compatible for the entire state. But there are large parts of South Dakota where it is a problem just to even get cell coverage.
I'll jump in. This is John Letney again. I think that idea has some merit for further research. The key, as I think several of us have talked about, is making sure that the technology exists and the cell service and so on to be able to access it. And typically that is one of the roadblocks. I think in certain cases it absolutely makes sense for a variety of reasons, and it may be that an officer can use a remote access type of system to inquire, to start an investigation, to provide some outreach, to maybe answer some questions, and there are others where it just wouldn't fit. We use a remote system such as that to access our county magistrate to get warrants, for example. So it saves officers driving into the courthouse or the jail get a warrant or something like that and then drive back to serve it. So we're saving some time in that, and there are some positive results of it. When it comes to providing other services like healthcare, intervention, maybe mental health services, I think it's better than nothing, but I also wonder what the comfort level of the healthcare system is in providing that service, and is there a liability where they will not and will still say, no, you police officer need to take this person to an intervention site or a place where they can get physical treatment. And I think we would have to look at that very closely, but I think the idea has merit.
Director Keith, this is Mike Keller.
Yes, Chief, you're recognized.
Commissioner Sullivan, I wanted to add into there. One of the things I talked about, one of the top issues for rural law enforcement is the lack of training, and that training is trying to get that training out to the rural areas. as been mentioned by others, a lot of our rural areas have almost no internet access or very low. And if we did this increase of the broadband, that would go a long ways for a number of issues in rural. If nothing else, not necessarily the health part, but if we were able to increase the broadband across the state and reach those rural areas, it will increase and improve connectability for our officer, for our rural agencies. A lot of them don't have mobile laptops and equipment like that because they don't have access. And then also remote training would be a huge increase. So it's not related, but just that alone would have a huge impact on rural law enforcement.
Thanks, Chief. Other commissioners with questions? Other commissioners with questions for our panelists? Hearing no further questions, let me close by thanking our panelists once again for your time and most valuable testimony, certainly the responses to the questions from commissioners. On behalf of the Attorney General and his leadership team of Rachel Bissick and Jeff Avita and all the commissioners, your contribution provided today are most sincerely appreciated and will assist this commission in their deliberations and work. Also, please check the President's Commission page for additional updates of documents and information on the Maine Justice website. We'll update it regularly when information is available for posting. One small note for the commissioners, tomorrow's call will be at 3:30 p.m. Tomorrow's call will be at 3:30 p.m. and focus on geographic issues for rural and tribal communities. And on Thursday, we'll go back to our regular 2 p.m. time and focus on the criminal justice system in Indian country. We want to thank again the FBI for the use of their teleconference network and support, as well as the federal program staff for supporting all the work of the commission. Are there any questions or comments from commissioners? If there's no further business for us today, the President's Commission is adjourned. Thank you, commissioners, for your continued dedication and commitment.
Thank you, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect your phone lines and have a great rest of the week.